Hey, it's Max. Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about someone who is making today's show possible. That someone is Audible. And if you're listening to this show, that means you like to listen to things. And it also means that you like to listen to people who write things, talk about those things that they write, which means that you would probably also like to listen to those people who write things, read the things that they write to you out loud. That is a totally convoluted way to explain what Audible is, because what Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks in the world. They've got over 180,000. Basically, any book you would want is on there, and lots of them are actually read by the authors themselves. One that is top of mind for me at the moment, Tiny Beautiful Things, Cheryl Strayed's collection of her Dear Sugar columns. That was one of my favorite interviews that I did last year, and you can go listen to Cheryl Strayed right now read you those columns. What a gift! Even better, you can do it for free because Audible is giving our listeners a 30-day free trial. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/longform. That's audiblepodcast.com/longform. Try it out for free for 30 days. No risk, all reward. Thanks, Audible. Here's the show.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm joined by the long form guys, Max Linsky, Aaron Lammer.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
What's up, guys?
I was just listening to this show last night.
What?
Were you re-listening to one of your old interviews?
No, I was listening to you guys.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising.
Yeah.
Ran out of podcasts, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what happened.
You turned it off halfway through?
I was disgusted.
It is. You are our number one critic. Evan.
Yes.
You did the interview that Aaron's not going to listen to this week.
True.
Hey.
He'll listen to it later, like months and months later, possibly.
Maybe.
Not.
Who was it?
It was Grant Wall. Grant Wall is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. He's also on TV sometimes doing soccer games. As you guys may or may not know, I'm quite a soccer fan. And I love Grant Wall partly because he was covering soccer way before it was getting to be a pretty big sport in the broader media, and also because he brings a real long-form sensibility to this kind of beat reporting and goes for big, longer stories, and it was fun to talk to him.
If any of our listeners, after going through all these episodes, have been jonesing, wishing, dreaming that they could have taken McPhee's nonfiction, as literary nonfiction, whatever the class is.
Mm-hmm.
The legendary class at Princeton, this is another episode in which someone basically says, I learned how to do this in that class.
If we do enough episodes, we're eventually going to reverse engineer that entire course. Because I've asked everyone who's taken that course, I've sort of asked, like, well, can you like give an example of what happened or like what was taught? And everyone's given a completely different example. So we're slowly going to unpack the entire course.
Don't go to Princeton. Just keep listening. What about sponsors this week?
As always, MailChimp helps us make this happen. MailChimp, I'll say one thing I like about MailChimp. If you got a little project getting off the ground, you're not sure where it's going, you can get a MailChimp list going for no money. You don't pay until you hit a certain number of subscribers. So there's nothing stopping you from getting a MailChimp list today.
And also, once you have tons of subscribers, which we do,
yep,
they manage it all perfectly. Like, I don't even understand how we send an email to, I don't know, what is it, like 100,000 people now?
You have 100,000 people on your mailing list?
Oh, yeah, we got a lot of people.
Damn.
Anyway, MailChimp handles it. That's how we do it.
While we're talking about things that we share with the world via our mailing lists, there's a new Atavist magazine story out.
Oh.
It's called Hidden Damages. It's by M.R. O'Connor. She has deeply, deeply reported the story of a father who lost his daughter in a terrorist attack and then spent a decade and a half, all the way up to today, really fighting for damages from the Republic of Iran in compensation for that loss. It's a great story.
Where can we find that, Evan?
You could find it at magazine.atavist.com.
Or right there in the show notes. Read that, but first, listen to Evan and Grant Wall.
Grant Wall, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I have been following your work for so long, partly because I used to be really interested in college basketball. For some reason, I'm not as much anymore.
Me neither.
I'm like, yeah, you're off the beat. So, and I'm an obsessive soccer fan, as probably like podcast listeners to this podcast will know. And there was a point at which you felt like you were the only person in America writing about soccer in like a serious way for like a serious publication. I wanted to first figure out how you got to that point to writing for Sports Illustrated, because I read in an article somewhere, an interview that you did somewhere, that you at some point earlier in your life told your friends that you were going to be a Sports Illustrated writer.
So I got for Christmas in 1982 from my parents a gift subscription to Sports Illustrated magazine.
Did it come with that football phone? They used to have like
It was not like the year of the football phone, so I actually missed out on it.
Yeah,
unfortunately. But it became something I read cover to cover every week. We would get it on Thursdays in Kansas City, where I grew up. And really, that was sort of my way into this world. And even by a pretty early age, I knew I wasn't going to be a professional athlete.
But you had played sports, liked sports as a kid? Or?
Yeah, I loved sports. You know, yeah. Growing up in Kansas, KU basketball is a huge thing.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into college basketball. You know, there were other sports too. I was a huge Chiefs fan, huge Royals fan. You know, looking even in soccer terms, there were no outdoor teams at the time, but there was indoor soccer in Kansas City, and the fabled Kansas City Comets were a team that I followed quite closely. But I started reading Sports Illustrated every week, felt like I got to know the writers.
Yeah.
You know, they had these unique voices, and guys like Frank DeFord became these mythical hero figures to me. So I would totally fanboy out in college a couple of times when I got to meet Frank DeFord, and he even allowed me to go interview him at his house during the 94 World Cup, and I was a student, and he had no reason to let me come and do this and talk to him about soccer, which is not his favorite sport, by the way.
He's always shitting on soccer.
Often.
Or he used to.
Yeah, he still sort of does, but what's funny is he's sort of accepted now that soccer's become something in the U.S. He's just not a big MLS guy now. But he was really cool to speak to me at that time. And by then, even toward the end of high school, I had told my friends, you know, I'd love to write for Sports Illustrated someday. I had never traveled outside the United States. I'd never been to the East Coast. The first time I ever went was to visit Princeton, where I'd gotten in. I figured, well, I should check this place out. And my whole family went to the University of Kansas. I thought I was going to go there too.
Yeah.
Long story short, got a nice financial deal and went to Princeton, where Frank DeFord went, where a lot of writers that I really liked went, guys like David Remnick. I wanted to sort of do things that might give me a chance to actually work for Sports Illustrated someday. That was like the end goal.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever talked to someone who like met like a life dream that they had so early, so specifically.
It causes you to kind of rearrange your goals when it happens that early, you know?
Yeah. So how did you get a job at Sports Illustrated?
So I was probably a bit of a stalker, I think is the best way to put it, in a sort of uncomfortable way at times. Frank DeFord taught a class at Princeton that was an application-only class in the American Studies department. And like there were 20 spots in the class, and I had learned like more than 200 people applied. And I, in the end, did not get in because you had to be a member of the American Studies department, which I was not, as he explained to me after I sent him letter after letter. When I say stalker, he may have forgotten this or put it out of his mind, but I don't forget that. And
your letter just said, I want to be in your class. Someday I will write for Sports Illustrated. This is my goal.
Well, I tried not to be a jerk about it, but I was just trying to explain to him how important it was to me. This is like my hero. Mm-hmm. Who's teaching a class at my school, and I can't get in, and did not get in. And I think he took pity on me and had lunch with me one day when he was in town for the class and did that interview with me later on. But that was, you know, one of the things I did in college to try and pursue all this stuff. I contacted Peter Carey, who was the number two guy at Sports Illustrated, another Princeton guy. You know, at least made some contacts as time went on and worked really hard, you know, in doing writing on campus to try and get some good clips. But I struck out on internships in the summer at newspapers everywhere, you know, didn't have any luck with that. Took some classes, thankfully, that allowed me to have some really good experiences with legit writers.
Mm-hmm.
The best one for me early on was one with Gloria Emerson, who kind of strangely became this semi-best friend of mine at, you know, this 70-year-old woman who was a former New York Times war correspondent in Vietnam.
Mm.
I don't know how much people know of Gloria Emerson these days. She passed away a few years ago, but just an amazing, tough New Yorker who started out in fashion writing, ended up becoming a war correspondent and a legendary one in Vietnam. I guess you could call her my mentor. I mean, like, long story short, she ended up having a huge influence on me wanting to go into writing and long form and all that stuff. So she actually let me have a key to her place and a room where I could do all of my writing. Another course I took later on, in a magazine writing course in college, was with David Remnick, who subbed in for John McPhee. McPhee would teach this literature of fat course 2 out of every 3 years.
Yeah, it's funny, like a number of people have been on the podcast who took that class, like John Seabrook talked about that class. And then I've heard David Remnick talk at points about when he took that class, when he was there, I believe.
Yeah, no, he did. And, and I happened to get in, I think this was 95, it was a year that McPhee was not teaching it and Remnick was.
Oh, interesting.
And so I actually went down, and I have it here, my old spiral notebook from Humanities 440, Literature of Fact. And I was looking through it today, and it's amazing to me how many of the things we talked about in that class 20 years ago about approaching writing a magazine story, reporting, organizing, writing a lead, getting everything together, structure, all of that stuff is stuff that I use now and use all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't really deviated from a lot of that.
It strikes me that that class is like an expert class. Like, it's a class, like, it's like if you were taking like pre-med classes and then some brain surgeon came in and taught you, like the best brain surgeon was basically like, here's how you do brain surgery. But then if you actually leave undergrad and get a job, like, no one's going to assign you that story that needs to be structured in the like AGGH, like the way that John McPhee requires, like a huge. So obviously you got that knowledge, which you still use today. And then how long did it take it before you actually applied that knowledge to stuff you were able to work on?
Well, thankfully, there were some opportunities earlier on, not for a big audience. One of the great things about having a seminar like that with a Remnick or a McPhee or a Gloria Emerson is that here are people who are being paid, basically, to care about you and what you're doing. And they do care. I mean, they're not just doing it for the money. But I had not done anything to that point to actually deserve having someone of that stature, you know, work with me that closely on something. Mm-hmm. None of us had.
Yeah.
And yet they do. And so that opportunity is something that I just didn't want to pass up. And so when I would take these writing seminars, honestly, I wouldn't focus that much on my other classes or some of my other like work that semester. I would focus mostly on these writing classes and put a lot into it. I remember in Remnick's course, we had a big project, a big magazine article we had to write by the end of the semester. And I wrote mine on Gloria Emerson, was kind of an interesting full circle thing. Huh. But here was someone who was a public figure. She won a National Book Award in 1977, who admitted that she kind of couldn't leave the Vietnam War behind.
Yeah.
And that, in essence, became my story. So that whole class just was able to kind of, one of a few things that told me I want to do this for a living, but it's one thing to kind of want to do that and then to actually do it. But I got to use some of those techniques that we're talking about in some long form stories. The summer of 94, World Cup year in the United States, by the way.
Yeah.
I was between my sophomore and junior years of college, had won a scholarship that allowed me to spend 3 weeks in Argentina and then 3 weeks in Boston, reporting on, as I pitched it, the cultures around the sports of soccer in Argentina and baseball in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, Argentina was playing in the World Cup, their first two games in Boston. Yeah. So I went to those.
Yeah.
And this was the first time I'd ever left the United States. I actually have that notebook too. I was going through this really? Morning. Just to kind of like, it was fun to kind of go back and see the journal entries I was writing, just like first day in Argentina, you know?
Yeah.
And just was trying to find good stories to write about. And so I did a number of things in Buenos Aires. The most interesting one was I traveled overnight with the hardcore fans of Boca Juniors.
Yeah.
And all these Argentines are telling me, what are you doing? You're going to die. These people will kill people. And we had to travel overnight because they had problems with the cops stopping them if they traveled during the day. We go to Rosario for a game against Rosario Central. And they kind of welcomed me into their little culture. And I ended up writing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Then went to Boston, did a lot of stuff with the like Red Sox and baseball culture in Boston, and used these techniques that I had sort of learned in Remnick's course of, you know, when you're reporting, get all of your stuff into one file. You know, all of your interviews, organize it.
Yeah.
You know, follow your instincts on how many people you talk to, how much reporting you do before you're ready to go to write. Write a lead section first. And going back through McPhee's notes, it was interesting because his whole thing was your lead section, your lead should shine a light through the rest of the story.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was a cool turn of phrase.
Yeah.
For McPhee, he would get so sort of blocked by writer's block that he would tell stories about tying himself to a chair,
mm-hmm.
To actually get the writing done. But, and this shows what a horrible imitator I was. The first couple of years when I was writing, I would literally tie myself to a chair. Writing was gonna be an intense thing, but it was gonna be a really rewarding thing. And that trip to Argentina and Boston that summer and the writing that resulted from it, I knew I wanted to do this.
Is that what got you the job at Sports Illustrated initially?
I think it helped. I started out as a fact checker. I got an offer in the spring of my senior year of college from Bambi Wolf, who was the chief of reporters and who I would argue has had a bigger influence on Sports Illustrated as a whole than maybe any other person of the last 20, 30 years, because she hired so many young writers who ended up being writers at Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
I decided to go to Sports Illustrated as a fact checker. I was going to give myself 3 years. If I'm not a full-time writer after 3 years, I'm going to get a newspaper job somewhere.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to put Grant and Evan on hold for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsors this week. First up is Squarespace. And if you have an idea for a website that you've been meaning to do, maybe it's a portfolio for your work, maybe it's something for your business, maybe you just want to test out an idea and see if you can take the world by storm. If you need a website, you should use Squarespace. Here's why. You don't need to know a lick of code. Their tools are super intuitive. You can make a beautiful website without one stitch of code. They've got great 24/7 support, so if you hit a snag, you probably won't. But if you do, they've got your hand. They're going to hold it. They're going to help you through your problem. And it looks great on any device. All the platforms. Squarespace stuff just works. That's the deal. Also part of the deal, you can start a trial right now. No credit card required. Go build the site that you've been thinking about. If you do end up wanting to use Squarespace, use the code LONGFORM when you make your first purchase. You'll get 10% off. You'll be showing your support of the show, which we really appreciate. And if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name. So pretty good deal. If you got a website you've been thinking about, Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Also sponsoring the show this week, the latest novel from number one New York Times bestselling author Karen Marie Manning. It's called Feverborn. It's in the Fever series. And I'm just going to read you this description because it's going to do it way more justice than I can. Mac, Barons, Royden, and Jada are back and the stakes have never been higher or the chemistry hotter. Hurtling us into a realm of labyrinth, intrigue, and consummate seduction, Feverborn is a riveting tale of ancient evil, lust, betrayal, forgiveness, and the redemptive power of love. Once a normal city possessing a touch of ancient magic, Dublin is now a treacherously magical city with only a touch of normal. And on those war-torn streets, Mac will come face to face with her most savage enemy yet, herself. Go check out this book. How can you not check out this book after that description? It's called Feverborn. It's the latest one in the Epic Fever series. It's by Karen Marie Manning, and we thank them for sponsoring the show. You can learn more at feverbornbook.com. Okay, here's Grant and Evan.
Did you like fact-checking? I was also a fact-checker.
Ooh, I didn't love it.
Yeah.
But I had a huge respect for it.
It's not pleasant.
It is kind of a thankless job in the sense of people only really notice when you screw up. But you also got to see process and how a great writer works. You know, I remember fact-checking Bill Nack's story on Roy Williams, probably in 98, 99, and just seeing how he went about what he did was hugely educational.
Mm-hmm.
And talking with him as the story went through the edit process, So, you know, those experiences were pretty amazing.
And within the 3 years, did you start to get assignments and start to find your way into writing?
Yeah, I did. It happened faster than 3 years, actually. So, you know, just little things came up. My first story ever was on the Howard University soccer team from the early 1970s. And this was obviously many years after this team had played, but it was a story about how they were the first team from a historically black college to win an NCAA Division I title in any sport.
Hmm.
And this was a team at Howard mostly made up of guys from the Caribbean, guys from Africa, a few black Americans. And they very controversially had their title, first title, stripped from them. And it became a real big thing with accusations of racism at the NCAA.
Their title was supposedly stripped because they had foreign
players or something? They had some test scores that didn't meet the NCAA's standards, but some of these guys were from countries where they didn't even get the test and, uh-huh. and were like really good students in school, and it was weird.
Yeah.
And then after it was stripped, they actually came back in 74 and won the title again and kept it this time.
Yeah, and it's a good story.
It was a good story. In fact, they're doing, I think they're doing a 30 for 30 on it now.
I was just about to say, it sounds like a movie.
And, you know, those guys, the captain of the team, are still in the D.C. area. And it was a really significant thing in the sense of, at the time, they were talking about this guys who ran things at the university would speak to the team. And they're like, you guys are a representation of the slave trade in the sense that there's the triangle of the Caribbean, Africa, in the United States, that you're this triangle of blackness. You represent more than just a team. And they looked at themselves as representing that more than that, as did people on campus. And for that to be my first story, I felt
That's
pretty good
pretty
about.
Pretty great first story.
And for it to be a soccer story, because at that time, I had no idea I would become a full-time soccer person eventually. Yeah, so it kind of went like that. There were a couple of interesting stories that came up where they would let me out of fact-checking duties for a couple of days. Uh-huh. I went out to Wyoming, this tiny town called Evanston, Wyoming, and did a story on the Jamaican bobsled team, basically trying to find a way to get back to the Olympics in 98. But this was like the number two team. They had one guy from the famous team they made the movie off of, which they themselves had made no money off of. Here were these Jamaican guys trying to train, but like working for Domino's Delivery in this tiny town in Wyoming that was all white.
Yeah.
And what was cool was after the story came out, they got some funding and actually ended up going to the Nagano Olympics. So a couple of stories like this, in addition to the fact-checking, like by, I guess, 1 year into my time there, I became a full-time writer.
So you started on the college basketball beat? Is that where you started? Or did you have a beat at the beginning?
I had a beat, but I had been fact-checking for it. So, you know, I was basically, when I was writing, I would do these short little one-page, you know, news of the week type things inside college basketball, which were fun for me because I was able to travel around and go to games at Kentucky where I'd never been before, or North Carolina, or and meet people and build sources and relationships. And now I do soccer on the side. Getting soccer in the magazine was really tough. And, you know, the 94 World Cup had definitely been something they covered, but that was a gigantic event in the United States. And so when I got there in 96, one of the few things we actually covered in the magazine was the NCAA soccer Final Four.
Yeah.
Which isn't that big at this point. We don't even really cover it much anymore. And then 98 was probably like the big change for kind of me doing longer stuff. That was the year that John Wertheim and I pitched a story on out of wedlock kids in sports.
I went back and was reading that piece. And I'm interested how it came about. I mean, I feel like there was a very delicate thing in there where you were kind of delving into this issue, which was very much like, in a way, accusatory. You've got these players, particularly basketball players, there are a lot of basketball players in there who have a lot of out of wedlock children. And then there was this part where it sort of like stood back and said, like, this could easily be seen through a lens of race and it shouldn't be. And I'm interested when you do that kind of story for Sports Illustrated, sort of, how does an institution like that approach that sort of thing?
All along, I sort of thought that because we were these 24 and 25-year-old guys, that they would probably give the info to some other better writer who would then write it. Yeah. Didn't happen. They trusted us. They let us do it. And I think working with John on that was just a really positive experience, because I think we both were sensitive to the racial aspects of the story, but also knew that it wasn't a black only thing. I mean, Larry Bird and his daughter and
yeah, that was
story.
A big part of that story.
We literally holed up for a week in a small office in New York and wrote that story together. Sometimes co-byline stories are done differently, where one guy will write and then another person will come in afterward. But mm-hmm. this was literally just the two of us sitting at a screen together and writing.
Whoa, that's intense.
You know, we had guys like Sean Kemp who were clearly, they had some pretty egregious examples. I forget how many kids he had with how many women, but I think it was like maybe 9 with 8. And we got letters afterwards saying it's actually more than that, you know?
Oh, wow.
I remember they put a 2-year-old kid on the cover, Greg Miner's son. Really well done portraits taken for the story. But I got to admit, when I first saw the 2-year-old on the front of the magazine saying, "Where's Daddy?" I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if that's what I was thinking of. I'm still curious about what this kid now thinks about being on the cover of Sports Illustrated, because he would be how old now? Probably 19?
Yeah.
So maybe not a bad idea to try and track him down and find out. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that story was in some ways foreshadowing for some of the stuff you see now around like the NFL and Ray Rice and domestic abuse. I mean, it wasn't about domestic abuse, although it was a little bit in there. I think a couple of the players had been accused or convicted of or something. But now there's this question of like, are publications, whether it's SI and their connections or ESPN in some ways, like beholden to these leagues in various ways and like can't report on them? And that seemed like almost like a simpler time in some ways, where was it a big deal to report so negatively on the sports?
I don't think the NBA was entirely thrilled with the story, as I recall.
I would imagine not.
I remember the week it came out, I was not credentialed for a Knicks playoff game.
Hmm.
One of the rare NBA games I was assigned to cover. But I've never had anyone at Sports Illustrated tell me that I can't write something.
Yeah.
You'll never have, at least I've never had anyone say to me, we can't write about this because of an advertiser relationship or because of some deal on the business side.
Uh-huh. And you also, you know, you wrote this book about David Beckham and his experience at the LA Galaxy. And that for that book, you had access that I felt like after reading it, they probably regretted giving you.
You have to ask them on that one, but maybe.
But I'm curious how you negotiate. I mean, how do you get that kind of access? David Beckham was the most famous athlete in the world, probably. Maybe you could argue about Michael Jordan or someone else, but one of the most famous athletes, superstars, celebrities in the world. And it seemed like you were completely inside this organization, both talking to him, but also all of these business people around it. How did that come about?
A lot of things came together on that one. So Beckham comes in 2007, that summer, to play in LA. And it's one of the biggest stories of that summer, not just in sports. I mean, it was crazy, the attention that was being paid, like on Entertainment Tonight and just in general.
At this point, you've been covering soccer for Sports Illustrated for a while.
For a long time. So I was doing, my first World Cup was 98 in France, which was a wonderful experience. And then Beckham signs with LA in early 07. They were interested, Beckham's people, in doing a big SI story. It ended up being a cover story of him arriving that they were going to participate in. And that was the second story I'd done on Beckham. I'd done a big, like, 10-page magazine story in 03, sort of introducing him to wider America.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, that had gone well. Had a really nice long interview with him and a bizarre interview with Victoria, who I kind of love, actually. I'm doing this interview with Beckham, and then her publicist says, you know, do you wish to speak to Victoria? And I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? Because they're doing like photo shoots at the, like in New York. So he was doing a photo shoot for Sports Illustrated. She was doing one for some celebrity magazine. And she's standing there, and I go over and say hello. And so my first question was, so how do you think you most influenced David over the years? She looks at me and she's like, well, I think I've really changed his dress sense. And I go, what do you mean by that? She's like, well, you know, he used to wear his pants really high. Now he wears them much lower. And I looked at her and I was wondering if like there was a joke, if I was the joke, I was the joke, basically. And actually it got a little better from there. So that story worked out fine. The story in 07 worked out fine. And then I got approached by a publisher, Crown, that was interested in having me write a book about Beckham's first year, first half year in LA.
Oh, so they came to you with that idea.
Yeah, they did. Oh. So I was living in Baltimore, but covering this team in Los Angeles while also working full-time for Sports Illustrated.
Why were you living in Baltimore?
My wife was there. She's a doctor, so she was at Johns Hopkins.
Ah.
So I started following Beckham and the Galaxy. And I think part of it was I had a good relationship with Beckham, had a really good relationship with everyone at the Galaxy, that a lot of people I'd known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just seen this cover story that was great publicity for the LA Galaxy. And I think that's where that access for the book kind of came from.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, even though I had a good relationship with Beckham's people, they did not want to give me one-on-one access to Beckham for the book. They were cool for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
But like they indicated that like it would take like $1 million to get Beckham to participate one-on-one for the book. And even then they would have control of the book.
They literally said, you will pay us in order to get access to this.
Because their
person.
View of it was, and maybe this is a very British view, was a book is either authorized or unauthorized.
Mm-hmm.
There's no in between.
Hmm.
In their terminology, this was going to be an unauthorized book. It's still a bit of a miscalculation, I think, on their part, because everyone else did talk to me one-on-one mm-hmm. over the next year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Beckham's voice is all throughout the book. One, because I was able to use, thanks to Sports Illustrated, my interviews with him for SI.
Uh-huh.
And he did press conferences before and after every game, so I was able to ask questions. It just wasn't one-on-one.
Yeah, I see.
And then there was all this drama going on behind the scenes, and I was putting in the time to be around and set up interviews, and guys like Alexi Lalas and Tim Leiwicki and Landon Donovan and Alan Gordon and Chris Klein, all these guys within the team were regularly talking to me, and to their credit, continued talking to me even when they weren't doing well on the field.
Yeah, and there was turmoil all around it. I mean, that's the thing that strikes me so much about that book is that if you told me in advance of you writing that book, I'm doing a book about the first year of David Beckham in LA, I would say, I don't know, that could be a really, really boring book because he's such a celebrity that you're never going to get anything good and no one's going to say anything bad about him because he's making all the money and whatever. And so the actual stuff in that book, I just imagined you doing the reporting and just tell me more. But how did you, I mean, the players were so honest with you. That's what surprises me. They told you stuff that they probably shouldn't have.
Probably. I think part of it is that U.S. soccer and MLS weren't quite in the same position then or now, to be honest, but especially then
mm-hmm.
as like the NFL or the NBA today. And so if you're a journalist, you can get more access.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a business book in some ways, not a certain type of business book, but there's a lot in there about just like the business of sports and mm-hmm. the ownership and like who's actually running the show and the celebrity culture and all this stuff. Do you feel cynical about the business of sports?
I don't, which is, I think, good. I guess I understand the game. I also understand that there's a lot of good people who play the game
mm-hmm.
and a lot of good intentions. You know, I'm around the soccer community in the U.S. more than anything, and there's not much cynicism in the soccer community. One of the reasons I wanted to push to cover soccer full-time back in 09 when I finally did was because I like covering the people involved.
Do they feel different from people in other professional sports?
To me,
yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like what we were talking about earlier, where the variety of stories in soccer globally, because the volume is so big, is huge.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I want to tell stories. And the American soccer player, both male and female, they're pretty great to work with. You know, I mean, there's not a lot of divas in this sport. They want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because they've experienced that this sport is not as big here as it is in other countries, and they're a little more humble.
But there's also this kind of, it seems like there's a flip side to that, which is in the U.S., you can go interview these players, and they kind of want to be interviewed. But you also do stories about these global stars like Mario Balotelli or Luis Suarez or people like that who you're kind of maybe introducing them to an American audience that doesn't know them, but they are the, like, huge super celebrity who never wants to talk to anyone. Does it feel like getting like blood from a stone to like, get anything out of these people when you sit down? Like when you prepare, you know, to profile Mario Balotelli, like how do you go about saying, okay, how am I going to get a full story out of this?
It's a challenge and it's not. So one thing I've learned over the years is the top European soccer figures, whether they're players, whether they're coaches, whether they're teams, they want to be bigger in the US.
Huh.
And as a result, they're willing to often provide access to US media that they don't provide to much of their own media.
Huh.
And that's something I've really tried to leverage over the years. And it's worked out on a lot of occasions. You know, with Balotelli, I'm a little bummed out his career hasn't taken off the last couple of years like it looked like it would have been.
Yeah.
But I've always found him to be a fascinating figure, and started laying the groundwork for a story on him after the Euro 2012 tournament, where he had two goals in the semis. They beat Germany, got to the final. And you're like, wow, this guy isn't just about potential and yeah. lunatic behavior.
Yeah, he was like breaking out as
you know,
a player.
This
yeah.
guy, but he also had this human story where if you remember that game, he went to hug his white mother, his adoptive mother in the crowd after the game. And it was a really cool image that sort of went against a lot of what we had seen in the British tabloids about Balotelli during his time at Man City, especially.
Yeah.
Is he a knucklehead? Yeah. Yeah, he is at times. But I also think he's a pretty innocent guy. And the knucklehead behavior that he's done is pretty harmless. And so I had seen a couple of instances where he had given interviews. Not many, because he didn't. And what kind of came through was he spoke better English than just about anyone realized.
Uh-huh.
He was a lot more thoughtful than anyone gave him credit for.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, that might be a really good magazine story.
Yeah, he's got a crazy backstory. I mean, he's a...
Yeah, adopted by a family in Brescia, was born in Italy, but not allowed to be a citizen until he turned, I think it was 18.
Right.
Due to laws in Italy. You know, he's had to deal with a lot of racism in a country that has a lot of racism still, especially connected to soccer.
Yeah. So when you say laying the groundwork, what does that technically entail for like setting up to try to get some kind of profile like this landed?
So keep in mind that my first contact, this was Euro 2012 during the tournament. I contacted his agent, a guy named Mino Raiola, who is like the Scott Boras of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Mino,
Scott Boras, for those who don't know, is like the super agent of sports
yes.
in America.
And Mino Raiola himself is probably worthy of a magazine story because he's like from this like family that had a pizza store and or restaurant. And he made himself the biggest agent in European soccer, just about. So Mino's response was, I got his email, sent him the pitch, and he's like, it has to be a cover. And I was like, I can't do that. You know, we don't promise covers. And so we kind of went back and forth for a long time. And then, so that was 2012. And so the cover didn't happen until August, I think, of 2013. And Balotelli had moved to AC Milan.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty tight with one of their directors there, a guy named Umberto Gandini, who loves American sports, had read my Beckham book, and really nice man who worked with Mino and Mario to get them to agree
uh-huh.
to do this. And also saying, like, look, this has a really good chance of being on the cover. We just can't guarantee it.
Right, yeah.
And so we met up in Miami in August of 2013 when the team was over here, and did this crazy photo shoot on a pool at this Miami hotel that made it look like he was standing on the surface of the water.
Yeah.
And I remember having to persuade Mario to do this. And I had just met the guy like 2 minutes earlier, right? And so my first task is to help Jeffrey Salter, a terrific photographer, convince Mario to stand on this clear plexiglass surface in the pool
uh-huh.
in the sun for about 45 minutes to pose for these photos.
And then you get what? You get like a set amount of time with him?
And then I was going to get time for an interview, which was, I think, promised at 30 minutes and went to more like 45, 50.
Do you prepare? Like, an opener? I mean, do you just kind of go with the flow? I'm going to meet this guy and chat and like, I'm going to rely on my natural charm. Or are you sort of like, I'm going to try to start here and maybe he'll open up?
I think one of the first things I said to him was, because I followed his Twitter feed, knew what he was into. He's big into President Obama, of all people. But I mean, maybe not that surprising. I said to him, I know you're into President Obama. There's a decent chance that he might read this story.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
He kind of perked up. I don't think I was deliberately misleading him. There was a chance.
It'd be great if you just used that with every player. You know that President Obama might read this story. I just want to let you know before we start.
And so it was great. His English was wonderful. He was able to really dig deep, I thought, and talked a lot in a very thoughtful way about racism, what he had experienced in Italy and elsewhere, what he symbolized, that he was aware of much more than people thought, that he had kind of let on. And one thing I was really glad about when people read the story, a lot of them said, wow, I didn't realize that he was that thoughtful.
Yeah. While we're talking, I'm going to ask you one more question about profiles while we're talking about profiles. Because I was reading back these pair of profiles, one of which is very famous, which is the one you did of LeBron James when he was a junior in high school.
Right.
So he was 17 years old and it was this big deal. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And what was the cover line?
The Chosen One.
The Chosen One, which he later got as a tattoo. I saw you
said. I give credit to Greg Kelly, the SI editor, who came up with that cover line because he got as a tattoo.
That's influence. That's actually what I want to ask you about, because a couple years later, you did a profile of Freddie Adu, mm-hmm. You wrote about him when he was 13, and then when he was 14, starting out. And if you look at these two people, the thing that was making me think a lot about was sort of like the influence of these stories over these people's lives. So clearly right. You had one who was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, hyped in a way that no teenager maybe should be,
right.
And could completely handle it and is now, you know, a famous sports figure and player. And then another one who it seems like maybe couldn't handle it, or right. At least was not necessarily worthy of it, and now is in a different place, still playing sports, but at a completely different level.
Right.
Do you think about the influence that these stories will have on the people themselves?
Yeah.
And like, especially Freddie Adu as a teenager, like, or both of these guys as teenagers, did you think about what does it mean to like put these guys in this magazine?
I think the longer I've been in this business and the older I've gotten, the more you really do realize how much national media, international media attention impacts a young athlete.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you mentioned this because in the context, this is right around the same time these stories were being done on LeBron James and Freddie Adu.
Mm-hmm.
One guy makes it, the other guy doesn't. And there were some similarities in those stories in that you almost have to have the obligatory two paragraphs where you throw in the caveats of like, you know, it's not guaranteed that he's going to make it, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason you're writing the story. And so you try to just find people who you trust, who see the talent and can tell you about where the potential is and where the pitfalls might be,
mm-hmm.
and try to strike a balance. I remember when they decided to put LeBron on the cover as a junior in high school, it was during the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake, and I was surprised that they would do a non-Olympic cover during that time. But then you also, I'd spent a lot of time with LeBron for that story. The timing seemed right. He'd had a huge ABCD camp the previous summer and had a really good experience. Flew into Akron and met him and his buddies. They all piled into my rental car and we drove to Cleveland from Akron for an NBA game
mm-hmm.
that had Michael Jordan in it.
Yeah.
And Jordan hits a buzzer beater to win at the end.
Did you know that was your lead when they got into the car with you?
Usually you have a pretty good idea on a lead when you witness it or hear it told or what have you. Kind of an instinctual thing. And after the game, Jordan comes out to talk to LeBron. And it wasn't the first time they'd met, but like I'm just kind of lurking and getting seen stuff. And there was so much going on there because you had the guy who was actually bringing Jordan out to meet LeBron was William Wesley, World Wide West, the kind of most famous connector in the basketball world in the United States. Not everyone really knows what he does, but he knows everybody.
Yeah.
So for me, I think I said this in the story, it was like that picture of John F. Kennedy meeting a young Bill Clinton, you know, where it was that kind of a vibe. You know, LeBron was that good,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I remember having Danny Ainge tell me in that story, like, there are only a couple of players in the NBA I would not, I would trade him for now.
I mean, you put in the obligatory paragraphs like, well, he could turn out to be a bust, but did you think if he turns out to be a bust and they put him on the cover, I'm going to look like a fool?
There's some of that. I remember being, we had gone to a McDonald's drive-thru on the way to Cleveland, and I remember just kind of offhandedly saying to LeBron, I was like, there, you know, there's a chance you could be on the cover of Sports Illustrated here. And he got this kind of look on his face. And I don't think you really understand in that situation what how it will change your life, at least especially then, until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's a documentary film that he was a part of about that time that he talks about the impact.
Mm.
It was big, but he was able to get through it. He had a crazy senior year where he got suspended for accepting jerseys as gifts, you know, throwbacks. And there's a lot of controversy, and that was a lot of stuff for him to fight through. But I remember writing in that story, like, he might even get a $20 million shoe deal. Well, it was like a $90 million deal when he signed it, you know? So, you know, it was just, you compare that to Freddie Adu, and for the story in 04, I remember going to Tampa where they were doing a photo shoot, a TV commercial shoot with Freddie Adu and Pelé. The highest paid player in the league was 14. And so a lot of people got carried away on that one. And so clearly there's an example that it's not guaranteed the success. And the attention hurt Freddie Adu.
Yeah.
Who was younger, we think, than LeBron was by a couple years. It's just a sad story in many ways, I think, with Freddie. And for me, like, I've always thought he's actually a pretty good guy. I went back and did a story on him in 2010 when he was in Greece for the magazine, spent some time with him. He's always been a pretty good guy to hang out with, go out to dinner with. You just wish that he had had more opportunities and had taken advantage of those opportunities at club level to build a career.
Yeah. We talked about, you know, you had a goal as when you were younger of writing for Sports Illustrated, and you achieved that goal, like, relatively young. Do you have a next aspirational goal in terms of your writing or your journalism? Like, do you want to move beyond sports at some point? Is there sports for the rest of your life that you could be content covering?
You know, I don't know exactly where it's going to go from here. My FIFA presidential campaign didn't exactly work out.
Oh, yeah,
in
we
the
didn't
end,
talk about
in,
that.
In 2011.
You ran for president of FIFA. That, again, was sort of prescient. That was before all of these takedown
yes.
scandals.
Yeah, and it was fun. I caused them to change their rules where to run for FIFA president now, you literally have to be an insider and have like two of the previous 5 years in football administration, soccer administration, which is actually a problem because if you had an outsider like a Kofi Annan, who I think would be great to take over a new FIFA, according to their rules right now, he cannot run.
Right.
I had a good experience doing it in 2011. It was fun. It got people to thinking, I think, why does no one ever run against this Sepp Blatter guy? And really put out some of the, like, honestly, common sense issues that needed to be considered about making FIFA cleaner or trying to or getting it a point where it wasn't this kind of joke of an organization.
Although the thing that could have happened was that you could have won and then gotten caught up in the corruption and you yourself could be in prison right now. Have you thought about that?
It
could have been irresistible.
I was going to do a WikiLeaks on FIFA. That was one of my campaign promises. Put everything out there. I had some fun conversations with people like the Iceland Soccer Federation president who was very nice and actually listened to me and then decided not to nominate me.
So you're not going to be FIFA president. Do you have any sense of where you want to go journalistically in 10 years or something like that?
I guess part of it is that I've never had sort of, aside from like this, I want to go to Sports Illustrated thing, I never would have predicted I would do soccer full time.
Yeah.
And that's happened. You know, I'd love to say this was all planned and inevitable, but it really wasn't. The sport has grown a ton. It's got a lot more growing to do, I think. I don't know if soccer is ever going to be the NFL in the US, but it's certainly...
I hope not.
Yeah, seriously. But it's definitely gotten bigger. And I really enjoy it. I don't follow a lot of other sports at this point. Even college basketball, I couldn't tell you much at all about what's going on. And I enjoyed covering that sport. My wife doesn't like sports, so I don't really spend much off time following it. And covering soccer, if you want to be on top of what's happening in the soccer world, you really don't want to shortchange your readers, viewers, and you need to spend a lot of time being on top of stuff.
Yeah.
Potentially, I guess, I could see writing about some non-sports topics, but I'm really enjoying writing about sports right now.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. I hope you keep writing about sports, because I need you to keep writing about soccer.
For the very foreseeable future, I will be writing about soccer. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. My guest was Grant Wall. I appreciate him taking the time to come in. Thanks, as always, to all of our sponsors, especially MailChimp. Thanks to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman. Thanks to our intern, Courtney Harrell. And we will see you next week.